Like a trusted turnout jacket you've had for years, Flex 7 outer shell fabric delivers a perfectly broken-in feel on the very first wear. Flexible, comfortable, and powered with the strength of Enforce technology, Flex 7 outer shell fabric is made to move. To learn more, visit tenkatafabrics.com/flex7. Flex 7, powered by Enforce technology, only from Tenkata Protective Fabrics.
Seconds count when responding to an emergency. Minutes save count when documenting your day. Emergency networking makes records management easier and faster with its fire and EMS solution. User-friendly, complete online and offline functionality, highly customizable, all at an affordable price. For more information, please visit emergencynetworking.com.
All right, everybody. Anthony Castro's here with another edition of the Command Show. And this is a particularly special edition for many reasons. Number one, we're going to honor and commemorate the brothers that passed on 9/11, not only that day, but since. And to do that, we have a very, very special guest, Chief John Norman from FDNY. You know who he is. I don't need to make any introductions, but I'm just thankful that he agreed to talk with us today about an event that was so sacred to him, affected him personally on multiple levels. Obviously, he lost hundreds of brothers that day, very dear friends, family, and also was thrust into a position of command on a level that I don't think he was expecting in the weeks that followed. So this is going to be a very important special edition of the Command Show, and I just wanted to start by thanking Chief John Norman for being with us today.
Hello, Anthony. Thanks for having me and for doing this tribute.
Yeah, that's what this is, Chief. Thank you very much. It is a tribute. For those of you who haven't bought the book, Chief wrote a book called Working with Giants, and he talked a lot about 9/11 in that book. But he has had such a storied career at the FDNY and before, and his impact has reached international proportions. And I found that book to be incredibly cathartic. I responded to New York on 9/11 with our Urban Search and Rescue Team, Task Force 7 from Sacramento. We deployed on the 11th. And one of the big things that sticks out now, 22 years later, was the loss of our mutual friend, Dennis Mojica. And Dennis was somebody I met at the National Fire Academy. And he was just somebody I instantly bonded with. I adored that man for the short time we knew each other. I still have the T-shirt he gave me from Rescue One. I still have his business card. And most importantly, I still have the impression he left on me.
The memories, that's right.
Yeah. And so one of the most profound things from Chief's book, Working with Giants, was where he talked about Dennis. I had no idea that he and Dennis were that close. And I always wondered what Dennis went through that morning, where he was working, et cetera, et cetera. And Chief's book, which I can only imagine was very difficult to write, was very cathartic for me to read. And I thank him for that. So we're going to talk about all kinds of things this morning. We're just going to free flow, see where it goes. But I thought maybe starting with talking about our mutual friend and the kind of person he was. When we talk about never forget, that this is what it is. It's not just a sticker. It's not a tattoo. It's not going to some event on 9/11. It's this. It's remembering those special moments with our brothers that we had that made them special, that keep them alive in our hearts. So with that, Chief, thank you again for being with us. And Dennis Mojica, what a character he was. And he's still in my heart. And I know I can only imagine what he means to you.
Yeah, every day I think of Dennis and so many of the others. I mean, so many fantastic people lost that day. I do an Instagram post, and just this past week, Stanley Ryback, who was a lieutenant in the hazmat operations, said, you know, it was a very stressful time of year for many of us. And my reply was, yeah, you know, it is very stressful, but I choose to focus on the good times. Remember all the great times we had with these folks, not just to focus on the loss, But, you know, we're privileged to have a, you know, such a wonderful career with working with such wonderful people. And that's what I choose to, you know, keep in the forefront, their memory on a positive note. So, yeah, Dennis and I shared a couple of attributes, if you will. We both started in the same firehouse, although he was years ahead of me. He had left before I got there. But that common lineage, if you will, your roots in the fire department in the city of New York, that goes a long way. When you could say, yeah, I worked there, and then you reach back and you talk to some of the people that you both knew and they kind of vet you, that helped a lot. I met Dennis. I was a new lieutenant in Rescue Company 2, and Dennis was one of the senior firefighters there. He was actually one of the chauffeurs. And when he started driving me, we were feeling each other out. You know, he's a 20-year firefighter, and I'm at that time a 9-year member. I'm a lieutenant, so I'm the boss, and he's this senior experienced guy. So he's feeling me out. And I was very lucky. We were doing a lot of fire duty then. It was December of 89. And we went to a series of mill fires, knitting mills, that turned out it was an arson chain. But that first night, I'll never forget, you know, we've been to fires before, but most of them were apartment fires. And, you know, it wasn't the real severe threat to your life that, you know, going to a knitting mill, a large mill kind of fire could be. So he, on the way up, going up Lewis Avenue, he says, "So Lou, you know, like, what do you want me to do?" And being the chauffeur, the senior man, he gets a lot of leeway in what he wants to do. You give him, he's like the second in command. So you kind of say, "Okay, Dennis, you know, well, let's see what the chief has to say when we get in." And we got into a pretty hairy position there. And it turned out fine, but that, you know, bonded us tightly. And then the very next night, we go to 2 or 3 more of those knitting mills, including one where Dennis was in bad shape. I mean, a collapse narrowly missed him, but then it cut off his retreat. And that was a real hairy period there. But when we came out of that together, like, we were very, very tight, to the point where we'd see each other off duty. You know, we'd go to dinner together, our wives, and, well, my wife and his fiance at the time. And then Dennis got promoted shortly thereafter. And a couple months, maybe a year after he got promoted, he calls me back for advice. He had been called by the fire commissioner's office, and the commissioner told him he wanted to assign him to Rescue Company 1 as a lieutenant. And he was a little bit nervous about it. He didn't want to be seen as being somebody who's getting something he wasn't in line for. And I said, "Dennis, you're crazy. That is absolutely, you are one of the most qualified people in the department. You belong there." And I was still a lieutenant in 2, and he was going to be a lieutenant in 1. And it was great. You know, he's a tremendous, tremendous guy, extremely talented, very, very knowledgeable. And he did. He took the assignment. And then about 2 more years after that, I got promoted to captain, and then I got assigned to Rescue Company 1 also. So we were 24 partners. He would relieve me, or I would relieve him each shift. So we saw each other a lot again. Again, continued to go to dinner together. In fact, our last dinner was in, I'd say, maybe August, mid-August of 2001. And he announced that he and Maria, his fiance, were going to get married. November 11th, I believe it was now. And he asked if I would come and if we could bring the apparatus. It was going to be held, the ceremony was going to be held in Brooklyn. So I said, well, I don't know if I can get Rescue One there because we cover Manhattan, but we could certainly make sure that we get either Rescue One or Rescue Two there. And then, 3 weeks later, he was dead. So it was it's a very bitter memory, but I think of the great times before that. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Well, reading that in Working with Giants was a privilege. And so anybody who's watching, I would highly encourage you to get Chief's book, Working with Giants, because he goes a little more in depth to what that looked like, what that felt like. Again, for me, it was cathartic because having been there that week, we had, through FDIC West and the National USAR family, if you will, through FEMA, we had met a lot of FDNY brothers. And Dennis was one of the ones who stood out. Bobby Athanas was another one for me. And I remember when I saw the task force tent in the melee at Ground Zero for your task force, I peeked in the tent just to see who I might know. And there was Bobby Athanas, and I thought I saw a ghost. I went, oh my God, he's alive. And so hallelujah. And I hugged him, and then as we're embracing, he whispers in my ear that Dennis didn't make it. And so it was like, gosh, dang it. It was a roller coaster of ups and downs, So I can't even imagine what it was like for you. And you were at the time of 9/11, not only were you not in charge of all of special operations, you were off duty that day
and had to kind of make your way in. And I wasn't assigned to SOC at all. I was a battalion chief up in Harlem. And fortunately, like you say, I was not only off duty, I was sleeping still. I was sleeping in because it was my first day of vacation. So I didn't know anything about the attack until almost 10 o'clock in the morning when I got a call from Battalion Chief Tom Roby, who was on duty in the 16th Battalion, and the recall had been announced. So he was now tasked with calling all the assigned officers, the battalion chiefs and the lieutenants who were assigned to the battalion, and notify them, the aides, and notify them to get them in to respond to the recall. So that was my first notification. The answering machine went off, and I didn't even hear the message. I didn't hear the phone ringing because I had turned it off because I was going to sleep in. And I hear Tom whispering kind of, John, I know you're on vacation, but there's a total recall because of what happened at the World Trade Center. So get in here. And I'm like, what was that again? I had to, reach over and turn up the answering machine because he had already hung up, and I replay it. And now I listen with the volume up and I said, recall, what happened at the World Trade Center? I had no idea. So I reach over and grab the TV remote and turn on the TV, and talking heads are talking about airplanes and both towers are burning. And I'm like, holy crap, what happened there? I had no idea. I had no idea. It had been going on for over an hour at that point. And as I'm starting to get dressed, I'm looking for a clean work uniform. And there's no, because I'm going on vacation, all my work uniforms are down in the laundry. And as I'm searching through the closet, the South Tower collapsed right in front of me. And I'm like, oh my God, I thought it was a bomb, that just blew it up. But now I realize that it was the tower collapsing after burning for almost an hour. So, yeah, it was a very disturbing image, to have in your mind. Again, fortunately for me, at that point, I didn't know we had lost so many firefighters because I thought, well, this thing just happened. A bomb just went off, and the fire department's probably still en route. And instead, they've been there on scene for an hour and an hour, almost 15 minutes. And hundreds of firefighters were on scene already. And we lost 343 of them. So
when you're coming into the city, you're a line battalion chief. Yeah, tremendous history with SOC, with Special Operations Command, but not currently assigned to it. And you're going in, and all these things are racing through your mind. And you're probably, if I recall correctly, reading the book, you're kind of you're trying to fight your way into the city and find your way into a station to where you can kind of muster up a group of firefighters to kind of get in there. And that sounded like that was really unique, obviously, and challenging.
Yeah, you know, the city had gone into total lockdown because we didn't know what else was going to happen. You know, we expected further attacks. We knew that in the past, there have been terrorist plots to attack all the bridges and tunnels, because New York City is a city of islands. You know, all the boroughs are connected by bridges and tunnels. So that was a logical terrorist target. So the city, you know, deployed police officers to all of them and stopped everything from going across except emergency vehicles. So as I'm on my way in, I hear that. I've heard that on the TV reports as I was getting dressed. And now I have to go. My firehouse was in Upper Manhattan. How am I going to get to Upper Manhattan with all the bridges closed and tunnels closed? So I had my second set of turnout gear in the trunk. So I grabbed the helmet and, you know, started in. I still hadn't gotten an FDNY uniform. The only thing I had was my FEMA go bag. I had my, you know, 3-day FEMA uniforms. So I did. And actually, I threw on a FEMA USAR Task Force uniform and jumped in a car and drove in. And as I was on the way in, I had to get to a checkpoint on the parkway. The state troopers had the parkway shut down, and I finally got there. And just about the time I got there, the North Tower collapsed. So now I realized that, all right, both towers are down. There's no firefight left. Now it's going to be a collapse rescue operation. And that's what I've spent, you know, at that point, 16 years doing and teaching, and said, okay, I need to get to the Trade Center site, go into the firehouse up in Harlem to be a battalion chief. Now became a secondary consideration that I felt that I was needed at the World Trade Center site itself. So, yeah, it was an adventure getting there. I got to a firehouse in Brooklyn before gridlock traffic absolutely stopped, and reported into that firehouse and went with a group of those people to a staging area just on the Brooklyn side of the Manhattan Bridge. And eventually we got called across the Manhattan Bridge. So I assume my timeline, I got down to the actual World Trade Center site about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, because it took 3 hours to get there. So by the time I got there, both towers were down already.
What an excruciating 3 hours.
Again, I was fortunate. You know, the timeline still hadn't sunk in yet that all these firefighters would be on the scene. It wasn't until I got to this first staging area and I met Mike Penna, and we're talking, and I said, you know, what do you know? What's going on? And he says, well, you know, this started at 8:45, right? And I'm like, no, I didn't. He says, yeah, you know what that means? Because we change shifts at 9 o'clock in the morning, 9 a.m. and 6 p.m. So he says, you know, we're going to lose a lot of people, because if you were in the firehouse at 8:45, we had the possibility of 2 shifts on duty. And that's what happened. A lot of companies responded with both the on duty and the incoming platoon. So we lost guys that, you know, were not technically on duty. I believe the number ended up about 20 or 25 off-duty people who were not. They rode with their company in spite of not being on duty.
Right. Like any firefighter would do, It's shift change. You're getting ready to come on duty, and the off-going crew busts a fire. You're not even supposed to start for a half an hour, an hour from now, but it's like, hey, I'm not going to miss a job. So,
not this job, you know, not this job. I mean, and, you know, there were people who said, well, they shouldn't have done it. Nonsense. If those buildings had not collapsed, we'd have needed every single one of them. That total recall, we'd have probably used, you know, 3,000 or 4,000 firefighters.
Sure.
Between, you know, the towers, if they, again, if they didn't collapse, well, who's going to go up there and put them out? You know, the fires in the surrounding buildings, you know, so.
Well, meanwhile, across the country in California, you mentioned your USAR, USAR FEMA go bag. And that made me realize, you know, that you've got this intimate knowledge of all these brothers that you work with, and you're going into your city, and you're still trying to penetrate the labyrinth of security and checkpoints and traffic. Meanwhile, I was in San Diego at an urban search and rescue task force meeting for the whole state. And I was at my hotel getting ready to go to the meeting, and I get this phone call to turn on the TV. And like you, I see the tower collapse. I think it was the first one. And I just fell to my knees and went, we're going. And this is the worst day in American firefighting history, if not American history. And problem was, I was in San Diego and they had shut down the flights, and my team's in Sacramento, which is on a good day, that's going to be a 7 to 8 hour drive to get back to Sacramento, and then have to drive to the Air Force Base in Fairfield at Travis Air Force Base, get on the C-5 Galaxy, put the team on the Galaxy and go. And I was in charge of logistics. So it was my job and my team's job to get us to get the plane, get it loaded. We had done a training with the airport squadron at Travis and done an incentive flight on a C-5 with our team no more than 2 months prior. So we were on a first name basis with everybody at the airport squadron. And so I'm racing up Highway 5 in California because I can't fly because there's no air traffic. And go ahead.
No, I was just going to ask, had you driven down there?
No, I flew down.
You flew down. Now you got to rent the car. Well,
fortunately, with a logistics background, you know how we can lie, cheat, and steal to get whatever we want. So I commandeered a vehicle, and one of the logistics folks from the Oakland task force drove back together, and we made it from San Diego to the Air Force Base in 5 hours, which the normally would have taken 8. So I think the average speed was about 120 miles an hour and only stopping for bathrooms and gas. But we got there and I actually beat the team to the Air Force Base, but they had my go bag. We beat them by about 20 minutes. The team shows up by ground from Sacramento. We get on the plane and we go. And, you know, like you, we're hearing updates and all kinds of crazy information as we're flying across the country. We had a couple F-15s escorting us. We were one of the only blips on the radar. And so when I read your book, Working with Giants, and I read the section on 9/11, I was mirroring your journey into the city and mine from across the country. And
responders were doing the same thing.
That's the point,
emergency responder was doing the same thing, even if they never ended up getting deployed in their own city. I mean, America was under attack.
Right.
And nobody knew where the next attack was going to happen. The Pentagon had already happened now. And, you know, we were going into a full defensive posture. So every emergency responder in major cities was expecting the same thing to happen to their city next.
Exactly. I remember it was a very eerie feeling driving north from San Diego through downtown Los Angeles to get to Sacramento, and there was no cars on the freeway. There was no cars on the streets. Everything was so quiet. I was talking to FEMA. I was talking to our task force leadership. I was talking to my logistics folks, and I was talking to the aerial port squadron at Travis. And you know, you must have been talking to 50 different people on the way in, and everyone's doing this and working their way in. But were you able to even talk to anybody? Was everybody just in response mode?
No, there was no cell phone service in much of the area. The lower Manhattan cell network was shut down, which affected like the command post and even fire department headquarters in Brooklyn. Cell phone service in that whole area was shut down. The TV antenna for many of the broadcast networks was on the roof of the North Tower. So even the broadcast networks went down when that collapse occurred. So we were operating in almost a news blackout. Once you got to the World Trade Center site, we didn't know anything about what was going on. People at home had a much better picture of what was happening than we did on scene. Visibility was so disrupted by the smoke and the dust. I mean, if particularly on the east and the south sides, you couldn't see 50 feet in front of you for days in many cases. It was just, you couldn't get a picture of the overall scene. Even we didn't get a helicopter view until several days later. And even that, you still couldn't capture what was going on because of the smoke and the dust around everything that obscured everything. So really, we were in a big, big deficit. I mean, every time I left to go someplace, I always tried to take a different route around the perimeter because I needed to see. It was such a broad, broad site. And it took days to finally get a like full understanding of exactly what conditions were like.
Right, right. And then, you know, as you're talking, you think about the NASH 5 we talk about in our command classes in our book and stuff about risk assessment, accountability, communications, the command, incident command factor, SOGs. I mean, all of those are gone. I mean, you have no idea, not only if there's more attacks underway in the city, but in the country, you have no idea. I remember the entire time we were there, we're worried about all these buildings coming down on us. So we don't know if while we're attempting a rescue, whether it's an intentional secondary device or not, or the building's just going to fall on us. So the risk is out the window.
Oh, the risk, you know, think about this. When was the last time an American fire chief had to request fighter protection? You know, that's what Pete Gansey did that morning. You know, I need fighter protection overhead here. You know, there were rumors of additional airplanes. The fourth plane that ended up in Shanksville. Now, our Office of Emergency Management had gotten briefed on another missing plane. There were reports of many more missing planes. So that threat was out there. Several days later, there was a report that one of our rescue trucks was missing. And the concept was that, you know, terrorists had stolen it, taken it someplace, packed it with explosives, and now would drive it back in, having unfettered access right to the heart of the command post and, you know, destroy all these emergency responders, including the out-of-town folks now. They would have been able to wipe out the experts from across the country. So, you know, there was a tremendous ongoing threat. You know, later on, there was the anthrax attack in October. We had, I think it was six real anthrax attacks in New York City. You know, it wasn't the suspicious powders. We did tens of thousands of the suspicious powder runs, but six of them were real weapons-grade anthrax sent to the news media outlets and through one of the post offices. So, yeah, the threat matrix was extremely high and tough to say, well, you know, we're going to take all the precautions necessary because you don't know what precautions to take.
Exactly. It was the ultimate chaos. Was with a country nationwide chaos, not just, I mean, the epicenter of Ground Zero, and then from there just chaos throughout the country. And so From a risk assessment standpoint, you're off the charge. From an accountability standpoint, you don't know where anybody is, who's coming, who's going, who's trapped, who's missing, who got out, who was on scene. That had to have been.
It took us weeks to finally get a definite accounting of everybody that was missing. You know, the scene was so big and chaotic. You know, you'd ask, you know, have you seen so and so? Oh yeah, I saw him around the corner. Well, we found their body, you know, weeks later. Or you'd say, oh, you know, where's Joe? And oh, Joe's dead. Joe's definitely dead. Well, no, Joe was fine. You know, so I remember, I think it was Thursday morning or Friday. No, it had to be Thursday, you know, going to Rescue One. And they had the list on the board of, you know, who was missing. Well, you know, no matter how prepared you think you are for that, seeing it in writing is, you know, devastating. But then we weren't sure about that. You know, the SOC command was calling hourly for updates. Have you heard from this guy? Have you heard from that guy? You know, are you sure that they weren't on vacation or, you know, wherever? So, yeah, it took a long, long time before we actually had accountability for who was there, who wasn't there.
Yeah, yeah. And then as we're coming in, we're getting more and more updates of the magnitude of and honestly, it didn't dawn on us until I want to say we were en route airborne, probably halfway across the country, where it really started to dawn on us how many firefighters were going to be trapped on top of the citizens. And it was like, oh my God, now we're starting to think. Then it got real personal. We're starting to think of, okay, who's in there? Who do we know? Who would have been responding? Who would have been on duty that day? But it still didn't, the magnitude never, like you said, we didn't have TV. We didn't have a lot of images until we got on scene and got there at the pile. And we're just dumbfounded by the devastation, by how flatly smashed these apparatus were, and cars are piled on each other, and headlights are still on, and windshield wipers are still on. And things, a lot of fires were still going, and just, it was a war scene. And
absolutely, yeah.
It was a war scene. It was an act of war. So it was a war scene. And you mentioned communications earlier, and we go, going back to NIOSH 5, even whether it's a house fire, room of contents, or 9/11, these are all five factors that are critical to success of an incident. So communications, like you mentioned, there were no communications.
Communications, you know, particularly in the towers, you know, they cost firefighters' lives. We knew our handy talkie system at the time was a point to point, excuse me, it was a local system. We did not have a handy talkie that could talk to the dispatcher or to hear the dispatcher's conversation inside the buildings. The police department used a different communications network. So our network in high-rise buildings depended on the building repeater system taking our message and repeating it, broadcasting it up through the building. When the collapses, or not even the collapses, when the plane impacted the two towers, at least in one building, that system was lost entirely. Now, it took time for the guys to walk because the elevators were out. So it took time to get up and realize you're out of communications network. In some cases, because the staircases were built in the core of the structure, if you got out to the perimeter of the structure, you could sometimes reach the ground or reach the command post. But it took time to realize that the system is not functioning the way it was supposed to. Now, when they gave the order to evacuate, people on the upper floors did not get that message. My brother David, who was a New York City Police Emergency Services officer, was up on the 31st floor, operating actually with Rescue One. treating downed firefighters, when the South Tower collapsed, everybody knew right away something bad had happened. They thought it was an earthquake or something because the building shook so badly, but nobody knew what. The cops, immediately, their radio system was able to tell them, the building just fell down, all units get out. And very clear, you know, this is bad, get out. The fire department units there did not get that message. Even when command in the street at that point was ordering evacuation, all units in the North Tower were evacuated. A lot of units just didn't get it. So communications was absolutely crucial. Like you say, it's always crucial, but in that situation, it probably cost people's lives.
Oh, no doubt costs hundreds, if not thousands of lives in some, on some respects, I would imagine. I mean, you know, and then finally the incident command component of, you know, I remember what was challenging for us was penetrating the labyrinth of layers, whether it was security across the bridge, whether it was finding an appropriate counterpart from FEMA or from FDNY. Obviously, everybody at FDNY, nobody at FDNY had ever encountered an incident of this magnitude. The largest, most sophisticated, busiest fire department in the world had never encountered something of this magnitude. Nobody had.
And you got to realize our leadership was decapitated. The chief of department's dead. Donald Burns and Jerry Barber, two assistant chiefs. Donald Burns was the senior assistant chief in the department. He had been chief of operations. He was part of the institutional knowledge. Gone. Ray Downey, who was instrumental in creating the FEMA task forces, gone. He would have been obviously the guy, and now he hasn't been seen. You know, he was last seen just prior to the North Tower collapsing. So, we were falling back. A lot of the survivors and, the assistant chiefs who had come in from home narrowly escaped death themselves. Chief of Operations, Danny Nigro, he was doing a lap around the building to get a report back to Chief Gansey when the tower collapsed and very narrowly escaped himself. So a lot of these, now they suck in, pounds of concrete dust and glass and, asbestos fibers and all the toxins that were present. So they were in no condition to really, jump right back in there and start doing things. Fortunately, several of the assistant chiefs were out. They weren't quite at the command post yet. They were coming in from home and, they were able to step in. But our command structure was absolutely decimated. So now it's time to start rebuilding. And it didn't happen right away. Reorganizational meeting at headquarters took place, I think it was at headquarters. I believe it was Friday morning. And, that's 4 days later, 3 days later. Because now we're getting a sense of who's missing. So now we have to start plugging in people to fill those voids. And that's how I ended up in my role. Chief Downey was still missing. Nobody was, we knew Chief Gansey was dead. We recovered his body that afternoon. A few other people, we had recovered bodies, but most of them were just in the debris pile and wouldn't be found for months, if ever. So they were treated as missing. So, okay, temporary appointments. You were going to be, and actually I didn't get the message right away. Chief Carruthers, who was the fire department, became the fire department's incident commander long-term, came to me and said, you've got Ray Downey's job. And I didn't know exactly what he meant. I thought he was talking about, okay, here you're going to be, I came to search and rescue manager. And okay, that would have been Ray's job. Ray would have been the search and rescue manager had he survived. And he said that, and I was like, I guess Ray's not, you know, hasn't been found. You know, there were people in hospitals over in New Jersey. So people were transported all throughout the region by private cars, by ferries, you know, people went everywhere. So we're trying to trace unconscious people in hospitals, hoping that we'd find them. So when it became clear that, okay, nobody has seen Ray, we've traced all the hospitals, and okay, now start plugging in the voids, and okay, you've got Ray's job. So
I can't imagine what that must have felt like to have that weight put on you from a line battalion chief coming in off duty to this immense devastation, starting to learn about friends and the impact, the magnitude of this, and then having that. Was the adrenaline just flowing so much that you just kind of said, okay, you know, going to just push on and take care of business? Or was it more of a...
Nah, the adrenaline, I think, was worn off by the second day. You just, yeah, you know,
you can't do it that long. It doesn't right. sustain that long.
You've been operating, yeah, you know, almost 48 hours, and you can't run on adrenaline.
Yeah.
You know, you just mentioned it, the other factor. I mean, Ray Downey, besides being his legendary figure, was also another close friend.
Yep.
He took me in as his lieutenant, gave me an opportunity to work for him. But then we taught. I mean, Ray was the guy that, you know, got me on the FEMA USAR staff, the instructional staff. When we did that first rescue specialist class out in, down in Virginia, Fairfax, Virginia, I believe it was. Ray was the guy that recommended me for that position. And we taught at FEMA, and we also taught firefighting classes around the country ourselves, he and I. So he was another friend like Dennis that, man, I couldn't conceive of losing him. And he was such a mentor. He's the guy that put me in as the captain of Rescue Company 1 when there was an open.
Right, right.
So to think about losing Ray, I mean, it was another devastating impact that, so now I've got to step in there. And when I went to special operations weeks later, I pulled into Ray's parking spot because there was no place else. There was a cone blocking it, you know, reserved for chief of special operations. And I pulled in and I moved the cone out of the way. And one of the firefighters comes out and says, oh, you can't park there. That's reserved for Chief Downey. And I had to say, you know, okay, get everybody together, bring them all into the apparatus floor. And I started out the thing with, listen, I'm here temporarily. I'm the new chief of special operations. I am not Ray Downey. I can't be Ray Downey, but I got to do the best that I can in memory of Ray Downey. So it's got to be good enough because it's going to be the best I can do. And if it's not good enough, let me know. So that's all I could do, you know?
Amen. Unimaginable.
Yeah. Anthony.
Unimaginable. I just want to, we're not, you know, we're going to talk a little bit more, but I don't want to go too long because I know I'm dredging up a ton of memories and it's emotional for you. But I do want to just take time to thank you even before we're done for sharing all this, because I know it's not easy. I know it's hard. But I thank you for agreeing to do this because of the opportunity to honor your friends, to share these important inside stories of what you went through and your connection with these legends and dear friends of yours.
Well, that's the most important part is, like you said, never forget means never forgetting. And more important, documenting it, capturing this stuff, sharing it with future generations, because there are kids, you know, I mean, firefighters today who were not even alive on September 11th, who have no concept of what happened, no concept of who these people were and how valuable they were to the fire service and to the world. So capturing this and sharing it with all those people for the future is important.
It's critical. And I think there's another element, especially in our country right now, of division. I'm not going to get political or anything, but one of the things I noticed when we came back, you mentioned being in a cocoon or kind of in this little bubble, and then the rest of the world knew more than we did when we were in the pile. And coming home 11 days later, I remember we got home to the Air Force Base in Travis again, probably midnight, and we drove back to Sacramento, which is about an hour drive. And every overpass at midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning, had American flags, had crossed aerials, we had a CHP Highway Patrol escorts the whole way. And we were just going, what is this? What is all this? You know, what is all this? We didn't know the outside of those few square blocks that the rest of the country had another process that they were going through of healing, unity, looking to the future. And that sense of unity that I know everybody felt in the weeks and months that followed 9/11 is something that I miss. And I sometimes feel like we're doing a disservice to those who died that day by not maintaining the level of unity we did as a nation in the wake of that terrible tragedy. We say never forget. Well, how about we never forget what came out of it that was good, which was patriotism, unity, cherishing each other more, letting each other in traffic, letting somebody take the lane in front of you instead of flipping them off. Just little things that took us back to a time when everybody was unified in patriotism and sense of unity towards what was good in America. And like we always say, it takes a common enemy sometimes to make adversaries come together, right? We were slapped in the face, punched in the gut by a common enemy. And for a while, politics didn't matter. It didn't matter. Yeah. We were all Americans.
Absolutely. And we're still all Americans, but we have to remember that part, you know?
Right. Yeah.
We're here. We should be here for each other and for America.
Exactly. Exactly. So when you wrote your book, did you find that process cathartic? And when I talk about your book, had you already processed everything on some other level, or was the book the first time you'd really processed your thoughts on 9/11?
Well, the book had actually, most of it had been written years earlier. I said in the book, you know, I would go through these events and guys would say, man, that was amazing. Somebody should make a movie about that. You know, somebody should write that down. So I did. I started taking notes. I still have them. I kept the response tickets for some of the events that, you know, really, really stood out. And I wrote the story down usually within a few days of it happening. And I kept all that. The first and the last two chapters were not written. They weren't written until after I retired. And actually, they weren't the last chapter in particular, the World Trade Center chapter. I didn't write that until I really said, okay. I had a fall up in the Adirondack Mountains in January of 2019. And it was very life or death. I mean, I certainly could have ended up dead up in that mountain, except for my wife was with me. She was spectacular. She went and got help. The Edinburgh Fire Department up in the Adirondacks, the Edinburgh EMS Squad, and the Northville Fire Department performed a wilderness rescue that was spectacular. And I started, you know, I was laying there by myself out in the woods on ice for about an hour and a half to maybe 2 hours.
And if I recall from your book, you couldn't move. You couldn't move while you were
paralyzed from the neck down.
Right.
I could not move my fingers, my legs, I couldn't move anything. So you're laying there for that time frame, contemplating the rest of your life. You know, man, I don't want to be a quadriplegic from here down for the rest of my life. And if I am or if I die, which is a real possibility too. I mean, there's plenty of wildlife out there that could have eaten me alive while I was laying there helpless. And you're thinking to yourself, man, so many things I wanted to do. So many things that I'm not going to get to do now. And one of them was telling the stories of all those people, you know, that I was privileged enough to work with. And the September 11th chapter in particular, that, you know, I had a very unique part of it. And I said, I got to somehow get this down. I got to get it down and get it out, because if I'm not here, you know, I believe that you have to share these stories with future generations. It's history. It's American history. It's an important part of our history. And if I don't get this down and out, well, that'll be a loss. So that's what really prompted me to do something with it and sit down and write those chapters that, particularly the ones that centered around September 11th, and then certainly the aftermath.
Well, for those of you who don't know, who haven't heard about the Chief's accident till now, you know, you talk about that in your book in a lot of detail, and it's graphic, and it just encapsulates what an amazing life you've led to this point, a living legend. And to after all you've been through, after all the fires we read about in your book, working with giants, all the narrow escapes, all these crazy fires, apartment fires, tenement fires, commercial fires, crawling around in you know, bowstring truss spaces, and just all this craziness, and then 9/11, and then to fall on the ice in a mountain somewhere, that wasn't going to be the end. No way. But I'm really glad it wasn't. And after talking to you afterwards at FDIC, I think it might have been 20 or 21, you know, you were still very fragile health wise and very guarded. You know, I went to give you a hug and you said, no, not this time. Because I give big hugs, and, you know, I have Tourette's. So if I hug you and twitch, I might throw your back out. So we don't want that. But you know, to put yourself out there with this book, you know, having responded and lost friends that day, to hear your stories and to hear that you had to fight your way in too. You weren't on duty. You weren't, you know, you had to fight your way in. And I thought, wow, even Chief Norman had to fight his way into the city to help. And that's what we had to do. We had to fight our way in because of the bureaucracy, the system, the FEMA system hadn't ever had a response like that. New York had never asked for help like that. You know, when did FDNY ever ask for mutual aid? You know, it doesn't happen.
Rarely. But yeah.
So whereas in California, it happens every summer with our wildfires. You know, we have large scale incidents that last a month. We lose hundreds and hundreds of homes, and mutual aid is as common as going on a medical aid call. It's just, we're used to it. So there was a lot of out of the box, steep learning curves for all of us. And for you to share with us your operational experience and the facts, but to share your personal story, your emotions, the relationships, is going to honor your brothers and our friends for decades to come. It is telling American history. So anyone who's listening to this, if you haven't already, please get Working with Giants by John Norman, because it is a masterpiece. It's easier for me to write a book than read a book. I have a short attention span. I have a lot of books that I start and very few that I finish. There's books laying all over my house that I've started in the bathroom, by my bedstand, in my office, you know. And I don't finish a lot of books because my attention span is like a hummingbird on crack, you know, squirrel. And I'm, you know, so, but your book, I could not put it down. I couldn't put it down. And I wanted to skip ahead to 9/11 because I'm like, okay, what is he? I want to connect with Chief Norman on that. But I said, nope, I want it. So I went through these pages and pages and pages, stories, unbelievable fires and battles and friendships and ups and downs and losses and lefts and rights that you had. And then culminating in 9/11. Let's talk as we close out here. I just want to talk about, like you said, what was the rebuilding process? Because you said so many things about, you know, you compare the Nash 5 on a house fire. Let's do a talk Nash 5 on 9/11. The entire head of the FDNY was decapitated. Communications were taken out. There was zero accountability. It was the ultimate chaos on an international scale. And everyone there had to not only contend with that scene and the operational aspects of it, but the emotional aspects of it, having lost friends, having lost mentors, heroes, people that were, like you said, with Chief Downey. I only got to meet Chief Downey a couple times, and he made an impact on me. I can't imagine having him as a dear friend, mentor, someone you teach with. How did you rebuild? What was it like after you parked in that parking space and said, "Hey, let's all meet up"? What was it like those that year after that?
Well, everybody, because of the nature of the event, the suddenness of it, you know, everybody in the FDNY was, like you said, so unified and shocked at the same time, but they were determined. They were determined to get through this, determined to make things better, determined to honor their friends. And it was just the sense of, okay, we got to do this. Let's go. And that was universal. I mean, one of the stories that I tell is about Dennis Murphy. Dennis Murphy was a captain in Squad 288, seriously injured just 3 months before the 9/11 attacks. He was badly broken up in the explosion at the hardware store on Father's Day. Still on crutches on September 11th. And I was working to find a location for the permanent FDNY command post. And originally, we were going to use the quarters of Engine 10 and Ladder 10 as the command post. And I was in there setting it up, getting, you know, logistics laid out, getting phone lines put in, getting radios set up, getting desks in place. And this is right across the street from the World Trade Center. The building was impacted by debris from the World Trade Center. The street out front is covered in steel. And I see Dennis Murphy come hobbling in. Dennis was a good friend of mine also. He is on crutches trying to navigate the steel that's blocking the street, you know, through the smoke and everything. And he comes in and he says, "John, I'm here to do whatever I can do for you. What do you need?" He's, you know, "I'll sit there." You know, "I'll sit there and answer phones, do whatever you need." That kind of dedication was just universal. There's 100% response to the recall. Every firefighter who could get out of bed, who was not in a hospital bed, responded and did whatever was asked of them. And that kind of attitude, you know, was, like I said, it was universal. And not just in the FDNY, it was, you know, every emergency service responder, everybody in the city of New York who really had a bone of humanity left in them felt the same way. You know, they were just, okay, We've been kicked hard, but we're going to get up. And, I tell people all the time, we didn't do it by ourselves. You know, the USAR task forces, I think 11 USAR task forces deployed to the Trade Center site over various time periods. Apparatus manufacturers, you know, we had all five of the rescue, no, well, yeah, all five of the rescue apparatus were destroyed. So many apparatus destroyed, engines, you know, everything. We needed to rebuild. And, you know, the apparatus manufacturing capacity in the country could not meet the FDNY's requirements in a year. They just couldn't do it. On top of that, you had every other fire department in the country still needs apparatus as well. They put the FDNY at the head of their list. They told many other fire departments, listen, you're going to have to wait. We'll get you, you know, they've got orders in already. We'll get to you, but this is an emergency situation. And every fire department just said, yeah, okay, we understand. So the whole nation understood the impact and responded accordingly, the way we would hope to see, you know. We talked about accountability, you know, that created problems in and of itself because we had all these unsolicited volunteers who came to the site and now want to help to do anything they possibly can. But they were outside the command structure. We didn't know who they were, where they are. We had no way to communicate with them. There were dangers all over the place that they did not get briefed on. And now, you know, at times we would issue an emergency evacuation because something was going, you know, we just discovered something bad. We had no way to communicate with those folks. So that created its own issues. But universally, everybody felt the same way. Okay, we're going to fix this. We're going to get through this. We're going to get better. And you just put one foot in front of the other and took another step and kept going.
Amen. You know, it's funny as I go around the country teaching a common challenge for fire departments over the past several years has been obviously COVID and staffing. And you know, it's the opposite of what you described. You know, there's not 100%, you know, callback rate. There's not a lot of people are not. We've seen it in California during wildfire season. We've seen it all over the place. And I hope anybody listening to this is inspired by your story, Chief. And I'm going to let you go because I know your back's probably hurting. You've been sitting a long time. But I want to thank you for this time. It's precious. I want to thank you for sharing not only your experience, but your heart with us. We're going to make sure it gets out to as many people as possible to honor our brothers. And as you mentioned, it's all that concrete dust and all that bad stuff that everybody inhaled. Our team
still
inhaled.
Taking a toll.
We have a lot of members of our team who are sick. I'm gonna do it, if you don't mind, a quick shout out to a dear friend, Randy Gross, who is right now fighting for his life because of cancer, and he was a dog handler on our team for 9/11, and it's no doubt related, 100% related, yeah, to 9/11.
It's and, still taking a toll.
It is. So never forget has a lot of faces to it. There's a lot of ways to never forget. So I hope everyone listening to this, never forget could just be having a good attitude. It could be showing up to work on a day that you weren't supposed to work because somebody else called in sick. It could be a lot of things. So it's more than a tattoo. It's more than a sticker on your truck. Those are good things, but it's action. It's attitude. And what you said about the 100% recall rate and guys hobbling in on crutches to make it work, unified and determined. I circled that. You said unified and determined, and that's everything.
Absolutely.
And one last thing, Chief, I want to thank you for the gift of writing the foreword to our new book coming out at FDIC 2024. That was an immense gift.
I'm looking forward to it.
Thank you, Chief. So God bless you, the NFDNY and everybody who's in the fire service. Thank you again.
Thank you, sir. Thanks for making it possible and remembering.